Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now, you're multitasking. But what if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. So multitask right now. Get your quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I know coaches, oh, he might not love football because he didn't play last year, all that crap. Like, do you feel like you get that blowback, or what's the reaction been in general?
I've got it from teams. Like I said, they just don't know.
Yeah.
You know, a guy can sit on his own and conjure up any idea he want to believe. But at the end of the day, it's just my personal situation. You know, with my mother being gone out the house and me and my father living together for that last year in school, you know, he knows my heart and my dream. And, you know, I lived by myself at school, and that's why my father was living by myself at school. So me being around all these guys, you know, and traveling, and at the time, you know, with the information we had at the time, it's like people tend to forget.
Yes.
Tend to forget that.
Right.
So it's like me being around all these guys at the time and not getting tested and going home and eating dinner with my father every day. It was something that I couldn't ignore, you know, that I didn't have peace about the situation. That's why I was the first one. You know, I didn't have to wait for anybody else. It didn't matter if I was the only one. You know, I had to play it cautious. That's just what I felt in my heart. And, you know, I don't want to look back and regret, because, you know, to this day, I'm COVID free. My father was COVID free. And, you know, I just got to thank God.
Caleb Farley, Virginia Tech cornerback who opted out in 2020. One of the best backgrounds I've seen over the course of the last year. All the hangers in the air. And, Peter, there was someone in the bed who was moving. And Sims and I talked about this yesterday. Whoever it was is trying to sleep. Go find another room to do the interview. Let that person sleep, for crying out loud. But, you know, important points raised by Caleb Farley. People made a conscientious decision, whether at the pro level or at the college level. And I do feel like, to some degree, it was held against them by football people. And it's something that Caleb Farley has to deal with as he talks to NFL teams about why he sat out for a year. Does it mean he doesn't love football? And it's unfortunate that that question gets asked.
Look, Caleb Farley, actually, not to blow my own horn, but he wrote a piece in my column announcing that he was opting out last year. And he was the first one. And I remember when I spoke to him about this at length, one of the things that he said to me, and this is what he wrote about, you know, he mentioned to Chris that, okay, his mom had died and he was not every day, but at least one or two days a week, he was seeing his father after being with his teammates and, you know, at Virginia Tech in, you know, an enclosed space in off-season practices. And so he knew that a lot of his teammates were going home and doing whatever and then coming back to school, you know, during the week and practicing. He had no idea where they were. Not that, I mean, he's not blaming them, but he's saying, I cannot risk guys going home and then coming back here and us being 80 or 90 people in an indoor facility practicing. I mean, how is that safe in an era of COVID? And he just said, I can't do it. I can't subject my father to this. And that's why I think, in my opinion, I think anybody who opts out, you really have to look at the reason why they opted out. And you have to, I know, I totally respect Caleb Farley for opting out for that reason. And look, all of these guys, they have their reasons. You need to look at each one individually.
And one very important difference between college football and the NFL. The NFL promulgated very strict and clear rules and regulations regarding gathering of players, regarding weight room time, regarding everything that could in any way, shape, or form relate to the possible transmission of the virus. And the NFL did an excellent job in that regard. The college football programs had no such oversight. They were all left to their own devices. Some schools, very careful. Others, not. And I remember when the clusters of outbreaks were happening last year at the programs as they were trying to ramp up, someone from the NFL told me, look, I can tell you what this is. This is weight room. This is too many people in the weight room, confined space, guys breathing hard, virus in the air. This is why it's happening. And yeah, if you're not comfortable that your coach is taking it seriously, and if you know the NCAA was asleep at the switch and really had no jurisdiction to do anything when it comes to implementing COVID protocols, the only prudent thing to do, especially since you don't have a paycheck riding on it, the only prudent thing to do is to say, as much as I hate to do this and as much as I want to play football, I can't in good conscience justify putting myself and my family at that risk, Peter.
And that's why all you have to do with every guy, like, you know, maybe you want to know, you want to really know why Penei Sewell opted out, why Rashawn Slater opted out. You know, why any of these guys opted out. And so the best thing to do is to ask each one of them about it. And look, you might determine there might be somebody who's just blasé about football, is a little bit passive about the sport of football. Maybe that's why, who knows, maybe that's why somebody opted out somewhere. But I think you're doing your team a disservice if you don't fully investigate that.
The issue also came up this week, Peter, because of comments that Ohio State coach Ryan Day made to you in defending Justin Fields against criticism that percolated last week via Dan Orlovsky of ESPN. Ryan Day made the comment, and look, I get what he was trying to do. He's trying to support Justin Fields and demonstrate how Fields spearheaded, in many respects, the effort to get a college football season at all in 2020 for the Big Ten. But there it is, the language that's highlighted in yellow. Where was everybody else? Where were the guys who were opting out then? You know, you don't love the game if you're doing something like that. I think Day crossed the line with those comments. And I think that what he did was said out loud what most college football coaches and probably many NFL coaches would believe, that if you do choose to step away, it is at least some small piece of evidence that you aren't as committed as you need to be to the sport of football. What did you think about what Day had to say?
You know, at the time he said it, you know, because I was really concerned with Justin Fields. And I didn't really realize what he said until I went back and read the transcript to our conversation. And I said, that's going to make some people sit up and take notice. But what I thought of it was that, in my opinion, I think a lot of college coaches believe that. And that they believe that it says something about your devotion to football if you choose to opt out, especially if your school has an environment of stringent testing. And again, look, when some players opted out, all right, people opted out at different times. And some players opted out at a time like when Caleb Farley opted out, the testing at Virginia Tech was not stringent. And I think it became more so, you know, before the season started. And so I think those are the kind of questions why you have to ask each player why he opted out. But yeah, seeing those comments now, they really make you raise your eyebrow.
When I first realized what Ryan Day said and realized that he had crossed the line, I thought he may try after the fact to come up with some lame, flimsy excuse. And I guess to his credit, he realized there was nothing else he could say. So the smart move was to say nothing at all. Otherwise, you continue to fuel the story and you bring it to the attention of more people and you make yourself look bad by trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube. But the reality is, because I started to climb up onto a soapbox and say, hey, if I had a kid who was getting ready to go to college, I wouldn't let him go to Ohio State given what Ryan Day said. But you know what? He's the one who said what 95% or more college coaches would be thinking. They just don't say it out loud. But that's just the way football coaches are. That's the level of commitment they have, and they expect everyone else to have that commitment too, even if those guys aren't getting paid anything close to what the coaches are getting.
I mean, one of his points, obviously, to me was, because I asked him about, you know, tell me about this petition thing that Justin Fields did last year. And he's the one who started talking about how, you know, he tried to get all Big Ten players to sign this petition, unsaid by him. You know, he didn't say this, but to force Kevin Warren, the commissioner of the Big Ten, to change his mind. Because Warren, you remember, had said, we're not playing football this year. And so Justin Fields clapped back at that. And his whole point was, because look, part of the whole Orlovsky theme was, you know, why isn't this guy more dedicated to football or whatever his quote was? Does he really want to be a great player? And, you know, Ryan Day's point was, do you really question a guy's desire when, you know, he spent time in the offseason putting a petition together to try to get all the players in the Big Ten to come out and sign it? And to basically protest to the league office, we want to play. And then obviously you watch the game against Clemson where he takes that, you know, incredible shot by the linebacker who got ejected for targeting in that game. And then he comes back and after that point, in the last 35 minutes of the game, throws four touchdowns and beats Trevor Lawrence. So it's hard for me to buy that line. And I think that is what Ryan Day was trying to say. And as you say, Mike, he did go too far.
Yeah, and look, he definitely and appropriately defended Justin Fields, and those are points that need to be made. If anyone is going to traffic in the negativity that is always out there when there are teams that are hoping and wishing and praying that they can finagle a draft day slide so they can draft that guy about whom they are spreading the negativity. It's the ultimate Machiavellian approach to football, and maybe Jerry Jones trying to plot some ways to plant some negative information about Florida tight end Kyle Pitts so he'll slide down the board. This one caught my attention, Chris Mortensen reporting that Jerry Jones is infatuated with Kyle Pitts and would obviously have to trade up at this point to get him. He's not going to be on the board at number 10. Anytime something like this makes its way to our consciousness, I just wonder how and why and what the story is behind it. And it could just be another one of those situations where Jerry's locked onto a guy that no one else in the Cowboys brain trust wants. And maybe the best way to derail it is to make it known so someone else takes Kyle Pitts so the Cowboys don't face that dilemma of loading up an offense where they already have more than enough weapons and their defense is woefully outmanned at this point, and they need to use that 10th overall pick on not a pass catcher.
You know what's interesting? I had a general manager yesterday. I was making a round of calls yesterday. Tell me this. He said, how interesting would it be if Dallas traded up to 6 and gave up their one next year? And, you know, as you look at this, you say, well, let's see. Miami's at number 6. Miami already traded up, you know, has made several trades, 3 to 12, 12 to 6. Imagine if they traded from 6 to 10. Now, you know what? That would mean for a one next year. That would mean that they would have gone from 12 to 10 basically for free. You know, when you think about it, because they would have ended up getting exactly what they got, you know, from going down from 3 to 12, and when they gave that one back to Philadelphia, to get that one back to go to Dallas at 10, it would be hilarious that Miami has been falling out of trees and landing on its feet. They're like the cat. They're done. I think Chris Greer has done such a great job in maneuvering in the draft in the last couple of years. And so, look, I don't think Miami would do it. I think they got their hearts set on taking one of the great receivers or Pitts at number 6. But it'd just be interesting if that happened.
Well, you take it a step farther. I don't know which first-round pick they gave to Philadelphia to go from 12 to 6. But if it's one of the picks they got from the 49ers, you gave that to the Eagles, you pick up the Cowboys' first-round pick instead. That's better than a first-round pick because chances are the Cowboys are going to be drafting a lot higher than the 49ers next year, although who knows. But as we know, not all first-round picks are made the same. There can be a gap of up to 31 picks between one and another by the time it all plays out. Kyle Pitts, clearly a great prospect, but from the standpoint of Cowboys' need, when you have Amari Cooper, when you have CeeDee Lamb, you took CeeDee Lamb last year when you had defensive needs. They've got Michael Gallup. They've got the weapons. They've got the financial investment in Dak Prescott. I don't think you justify your financial investment in Dak Prescott by ignoring your defensive needs and loading up even more on the offensive side of the ball so Prescott can have the kind of numbers that will make people say they didn't get fleeced by Prescott and his agent Todd France.
I mean, look, you know, the Dallas Cowboys, Mike, when I look at the Cowboys right now, and you know, I had the benefit the year that they took Dak Prescott and Ezekiel Elliott of, you know, being at their facility and seeing a lot of what happened in their draft room. And the one thing that stood out is that Jerry Jones, as powerful a person as he is, had an opportunity, you know, 5 years ago, basically to go against the family. He had an opportunity to, instead of giving a 2 and a 4 to move up into the first round to try to get Paxton Lynch, John Schneider wanted a 2 and a 3. And Jerry was the only one who wanted to give it. The other guys in the room didn't, including his son, Steven, the executive vice president. But Jerry Jones, instead of putting his foot down and saying, darn it, we're making this trade and we're taking Paxton Lynch, he didn't do it. He basically sat there, seethed a little bit, but he didn't do it. And he just sat there and they ended up not making a trade into the lower part of the first round. They stuck with their second and third round picks. And so all I'm saying is, just because Jerry gets a bee in his bonnet that he wants Kyle Pitts, I would be very surprised if he had any support in that room to trade a future number one, to trade up 4 or 5 spots to get one player in this draft, particularly if it's not a quarterback.
Kyle Pitts, though, safer than Johnny Manziel, the guy that Jerry Jones wanted so badly back in 2014. But with that defense and with where that team currently is right now, it's just impossible to justify. Unless you trade Amari Cooper for the ability to trade up, which I don't see anyone taking on a $20 million salary for Cooper this year. It just doesn't make sense. All right, it made plenty of sense for the Jets to trade Sam Darnold once they decided that Zach Wilson was their guy. Think back to 2018, Peter. It was that Saturday morning trade that came out of the blue. The Jets were at 6. They gave the Colts 3 second-round picks to move from 6 to 3. Now the Jets get far less than that overall investment, which ultimately is the 6th overall pick plus 3 second-round picks to get Sam Darnold. They give up Sam Darnold for a 6th-round pick this year, a 2nd-round pick, and a 4th-round pick next year. What was your immediate assessment and reaction to the trade that sends Sam Darnold to the Panthers from the Jets' perspective as it relates to what they got?
You know, my first reaction is that, you know, and again, this is a little bit rash, but is there any team in the NFL over the last 10 years that has changed coaches, general managers, and quarterbacks collectively more often than the New York Jets.
Browns. I mean,
the Patriots have to be chortling at the New York Jets. They really do. Because you know that Bill Belichick, every time somebody in his division changes the coach or general manager, he loves it because they're starting over, and that means that the Jets are, the Patriots are going to be in an advantage. So that was my first thought. My second thought was, you know, I remember, because obviously I live in New York, I remember when Sam Darnold was picked, there was a parade down Broadway. This guy's going to be the guy. And we finally have, you know, the next Joe Namath. And the night he was drafted, and credit Steve Serby of the New York Post for this, Mike. The night he was drafted, Christopher Johnson, you know, then the owner in place with the Jets, said, I think people are going to look back 20 years from now and say that this is the moment the Jets shifted into a new gear and became a great team. And, you know, obviously, in the last three seasons, Mike, team offense, New York Jets, 29, 32, and 32. I mean, it's, I have no idea what is going on inside the head of Zach Wilson right now. No idea. Or his family. But I'm sure they've got to be thinking as intelligent people, man, I hope this Joe Douglas knows what he's doing.
And oh, he's look, going to New
Jets
York.
Jets have a lot of draft choices right now.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
He's going to New York. No, the bar is low. Robert Saleh's the new head coach. I don't think there's reason for Zach Wilson to go run and hide at the prospect of being picked by these Jets. And from the Jets' perspective, you know, I say this about every team. If you're looking for a franchise quarterback, and you either have one and you know it, or you don't have one and you know it, or you have a guy that you're willing to give him a chance to see if he becomes one. They gave Sam Darnold the 3 years to show something that would justify the conclusion that he's going to be a franchise quarterback. They've made the decision he's not. And now they're rolling the dice again. And, you know, even though you've changed your coach and your GM, the owner is still there, kind of. Woody Johnson's back now. But you know you need that franchise quarterback. And if Darnold didn't work out to your level of satisfaction and the fact that you're back in position with the second overall pick in the draft to take another quarterback shows that it didn't work out with Darnold. You roll the dice again, and you keep rolling the dice until you get that franchise quarterback. So
I guess you do, Mike, but the question is, Zach Wilson is going to be the seventh quarterback the Jets have taken in the top two rounds in the last either 15 or 16 years. So, you know, at some point, don't you say, let's build a good team around our quarterback to give him the best chance possible to be good? And the Jets just haven't done that. And look, part of that, you can go back to John Idzik. You can go back to, you know, obviously you go back to Mike Maccagnan. But, you know, they have not surrounded their quarterbacks traditionally with great players. And, you know, Mike Tannenbaum did some, you know, with Rex Ryan, and they had that really good run for a while with Mark Sanchez. But other than that, tell me, what have the Jets done the last almost two decades? I mean, it's been a debacle. It's been an absolute debacle, which is why, in my opinion, there better be Joe Douglas right now, as much as you can say Zach Wilson's the most important guy, Joe Douglas is the most important guy in this organization for the next 2 years. He is. For the next 13 months, the next two drafts, he's the guy.
They did go to back-to-back AFC Championship games, though. They were laying somewhat of a foundation before it all fell apart with Rex Ryan and Mike Tannenbaum, but I get your point. They need to build the team from the inside out, not the outside in. Maccagnan was trying too hard to build from the outside in. Douglas is trying to build from the inside out. But if they believe in Zach Wilson as a potential generational talent, it gets back to what we talked about last hour. When you see that these quarterbacks, if they're great, can play for you for 15, 20 years, possibly, you grab them. It's the most important position on the field. And, you know, this is a great chicken and the egg question as it relates to great quarterbacks. How much help do you need around you to show that you're a franchise quarterback? I mean, at some point you become Archie Manning, but there have been guys who have shown us they are great quarterbacks. without a whole lot of help around them, just because they are special talents who can extend plays with their feet, who can throw the ball into a tight window, who can will a crappy receiver to get open and catch the ball through repetition and effort and leadership. I don't know how much help it takes around a great quarterback to allow that quarterback to show us he's great. And I didn't see anything from Sam Darnold other than the clips that the Panthers are relentlessly pushing on social media. I didn't see enough to get me to say this guy's a franchise quarterback.
I don't think anybody did, Mike. And that's, so you ask yourself, I mean, look, I'm not saying that Sam Darnold is going to be great in the NFL. I'm not. But what I am saying is, if you look at the offensive line and the weapons that he has had since he's been there, it's got to be right at the bottom of the NFL. And I don't know what number it would be. But their offensive line has been awful, and their skill position players collectively have been awful. And so at some point, if you don't take better players, how can you expect your quarterback to be any good?
You know, I haven't gone back and researched and compared the performances of Drew Brees in his years with the Chargers to Sam Darnold in his time with the Jets. My loose recollection is Brees was better with the Chargers than Darnold was with the Jets, but it's not unprecedented.
No question, yeah.
For a guy who you know, clearly wasn't good enough in the eyes of his original team by virtue of the fact that the Chargers drafted, well, Eli Manning technically, and then traded him for Phillip Rivers, but they gave up on Brees after just a few seasons, kept him around, and then let him walk away, and then Brees becomes one of the great quarterbacks of all time. So it's not unprecedented that a guy was regarded as not franchise quarterback material by his original team and goes somewhere else, and everything falls together, and lo and behold, you have a guy who's synonymous with quarterback greatness in the NFL. And maybe in 5 years, we'll be saying, what the hell were the Jets thinking? They had Sam Darnold.
I get that, Mike, but the Jets now have, in the span of 15 years, have taken six quarterbacks who they felt, at least to some degree, had a good chance to be their quarterback of the long-term future. I mean, you can say, well, Christian Hackenberg was the 51st pick. Maybe, but you don't use the 51st pick in a draft on a player if you think that he's not going to be a starter for you at some point. And so the Jets have taken six or seven guys who, you know, they thought, okay, we're taking this guy. There's a good chance this guy is going to be our future. And they're 0-6. And that's the only reason why I look at Zach Wilson and part of me says, poor guy. And the other part says, Joe Douglas is the most important guy in this franchise over the next 13 months, because these next two drafts are going to tell whether the Jets can get on the right track.
The Jets have drafted plenty of quarterbacks. You are right. Christian Hackenberg, the second round disaster in 2016. Bryce Petty in 2015. They had Geno Smith, second round disaster in 2013. Good God. Mark Sanchez traded up to 5 to get him. Now he still has 4 road playoff wins, an NFL record. Kellen Clemens. Yeah, they've been swinging and missing on quarterbacks for a while. And one guy, Peter, that they had temporarily, briefly in 2018, Teddy Bridgewater. They signed him as a free agent before they traded him to the Saints. Bridgewater's now the other side of this Carolina Panthers transaction. With Darnold in, Bridgewater, multiple teams interested in trading for him. He's got a $10 million fully guaranteed salary, another $7 million non-guaranteed on top of that. He's going to have to reduce his salary. And I could see, if you could get him for $12 million in total salary, maybe get the Panthers to pay $2 or $3 million of it in a Ryan Tannehill type of a move, fifth-round draft pick, sixth-round draft pick. There are spots where Teddy Bridgewater could contribute in 2021, and I fully expect that he will be traded to someone either before the draft or after round one, when a team like the Broncos, that may be hoping that they can get a Justin Fields, decides, all right, we'll go ahead and do this deal to get Teddy Bridgewater away from the Carolina Panthers.
Hey, Mike, points bet has 2, 4, 6, 8 points bet in their 9 teams is missing the one that I would pick of all the teams in the league, and that is Tampa Bay. And I'll tell you why. Before the Bucs signed Tom Brady last year, Bruce Arians and Byron Leftwich, you know, obviously they had to look at all the quarterbacks on the market. And I know that they had a lot of interest in Teddy Bridgewater and that they really liked Teddy Bridgewater. Now, could they in any way find a way to fit Teddy Bridgewater salary-wise on their team? I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know if they would do it, but if you ask me, just my gut feeling, knowing what the landscape was 14 months ago, I would bet Tampa. And one of the reasons, if you're Teddy Bridgewater, you consider Tampa is that, okay, I sit behind Brady 1 or 2 years, and then I'm the guy, because who knows who the coach is going to be of that team. My gut feeling is maybe 2 years down the road, 3, whatever. It could be Byron Leftwich. You don't know. But imagine if you were the guy to take over for Tom Brady. But again, all I'm saying is that the Bucs had a lot of interest in him before they signed Brady. So he's the team. That's the team that I think would have quite a bit of interest in him now.
And there's a simple path to Tampa, and it consists of Teddy Bridgewater rejecting any request that he reduces $17 million salary. Eventually, he would be cut, I'm convinced, by the Panthers. They owe him $10 million fully guaranteed. He could go sign with the Bucks for $1.075 million and have the Panthers pay the $8.925 million balance for him to be the backup to Tom Brady with a division rival. I think that's why the Panthers are going to work very hard and possibly pay part of the salary to facilitate a trade of Teddy Bridgewater so they don't have to worry about him staying in the division and being a member of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. All right, let's take a break. A little which doesn't belong and why coming up next here on PFT Live.
Around any corner, within every battle, and with the dawn of each new day, the threat of the unexpected, the unpredictable, and the unrelenting lies in wait. But Marines will always be there. They are the constant in the chaos. No matter the battlefield, Marines adapt to win, defeating every shifting threat, protecting our nation's future. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This weekend, it's WrestleMania, streaming live on Peacock, Saturday, April 10, Sunday, April 11, from Raymond James Stadium. And it's available on Peacock at no additional charge, no pay-per-view. Sign up to Peacock. I think you have to have one of the levels. I think it's the $5 level, and you get it. And look at this, from WrestleMania 2, the Rosemont Horizon, multiple NFL players involved in a battle royal. There's the refrigerator hitting Jim the Anvil Neidhart. Pull up your pants, Fridge. Those pants were coming down throughout the match. He gives Big John Studd. Oh, oops. That one didn't work out. And out goes the Fridge. One of the last guys in that one. And there he is, see him in the white tank top. Russ Francis was one of the last guys who survived. And Peter, he went over the top rope and he hit the edge of the ring with his neck. And you can see he grabs his neck. I thought he was really hurt. I mean, even though, if you haven't heard, it's not, you know, unscripted, guys still get hurt. It's still very, very physical. And guys get injured all the time. And some great old matches available on Peacock, all of the old WrestleManias and the new one this weekend. So, Peter, I urge you to check it out.
I'm not sure I will, Mike. I've never been much of a wrestling buff since Bruno Sammartino hung up the leotard.
Bruno Sammartino was in that battle royal as well. Bruno was there. They had Harvey
That's
Martin,
crazy.
Ernie Holmes. Listen, Harvey Martin, Ernie Holmes, Refrigerator Perry, Jimbo Covert, Bill Frelick was in that battle royal. They had a bunch of NFL guys. And you'll
what
never
about
get
Andre the
answer.
Giant?
Andre the Giant won it because he's a giant.
Wow.
They have all sorts of celebrities of the day involved in the WrestleMania activities. The person working the bell for the Royal or Battle Royal at WrestleMania 2 was the Where's the Beef lady from the Wendy's commercials, which were huge back in the mid-1980s. All right, which doesn't belong and why? Let's begin with Refrigerator Perry from WrestleMania 2. Lawrence Taylor from WrestleMania 11, Rob Gronkowski, 33 and 36, which doesn't belong and why?
I mean, I would have to say the fridge. Because to me, if I want guys who are really going to be dangerous in the ring, for some reason, I don't view the fridge as being particularly dangerous in the ring. However, I would fear Rob Gronkowski.
I say the fridge doesn't belong because, for me, no one ever burned as bright beyond the sports world than William the Refrigerator Perry, the phenomenon that he was in 1985. I remember it vividly,
right,
and it's never been matched by anyone else. And one of the most unlikely of guys that would have become that flashpoint for so much notoriety as part of the 1985 Bears. So the Refrigerator, getting it done.
Now, Mike, can I tell you a very quick story? Can I tell you
sure.
a quick story about that? The day after the Super Bowl that the fridge scored the touchdown and Walter Payton didn't, that's when I knew that there was something strange inside the Chicago Bears, because that was not a happy team. You know, they killed the Patriots in the Super Bowl, but it wasn't a happy team. And everybody's always said, it's so amazing that they only won one Super Bowl. And yeah, it probably is. They're very talented. But I just think there was just too much internal crap on that Bears team and in that franchise. The defensive coordinator versus the head coach, you know, Fridge getting to score, one of the greatest players of all time, not. It felt really weird the day after that game.
I love the Richard Dent line. We won a Super Bowl because of Mike Ditka, and we won a Super Bowl because of Mike Ditka, because, yeah, that's a team that they expected to win multiple championships.
Yeah.
All right, which doesn't belong and why? Tom Brady, quarterback whisperers, Charlie Weiss, Josh McDaniels, Bruce Arians, which doesn't belong and why?
Wow, that's a really good question. I would say, I think they all belong, but if anybody doesn't belong, I would say it's Bruce Arians, because Tom Brady was who he was when he got to Tampa. And part of who he was birthed by Charlie Weiss and Josh McDaniels.
I'll say Weiss doesn't belong because, I mean, look, he never was an NFL head coach. Sometimes these are extremely superficial and simple, and I don't have any other ideas. So I'll just say Weiss because he wasn't an NFL head coach. The other two became NFL head coaches, and Arians, obviously, a Super Bowl winner. Cam Newton, Jameis Winston, Andy Dalton, which doesn't belong and why? All three quarterbacks on one-year prove-it deals.
I would say Cam Newton doesn't belong because while the other two, I could see the other two making a second year in each of their places. I can't see Cam Newton being the quarterback of the Patriots in 2022.
Yeah, I say Winston doesn't belong because he's the only one that I really don't know whether or not he's going to be the week one starter at this point. There's going to be a competition. He's going to have to earn it. I think Taysom Hill has the upper hand. Dalton, we can call the starter, barring something unforeseen in Chicago. Newton, the starter, barring something unforeseen in New England. All right, new general managers drafting in the top 10 3 weeks from yesterday. Brad Holmes of the Lions, Scott Fitterer of the Panthers, George Payton of the Broncos. Which doesn't belong and why?
Well, I'd say right now that George Payton doesn't belong because I think that George Payton is in the worst position of the three general managers, in that the other two, I think, still could have the power to move around either up or down. Not that George Payton doesn't have that power, but the two guys ahead of him at 4 and 8 are going to have more influence at the top of the draft than George Payton picking ninth.
And Payton is the guy among the three who really doesn't have a quarterback solution. Even though the Lions could take one at 7, they've got Jared Goff. The Panthers now have Sam Darnold, although they can, in theory, could take one at 8, and Fitterer hasn't ruled that out. Payton, it just feels like it's an open slate still for the Broncos, and it feels like there isn't satisfaction with Drew Lock, a second rounder from a couple of years ago. Let's take a break. Controversial ending to the Mets home opener provides the inspiration for today's PFT Live draft. We'll do it next. We'll be right back.
Cartwright!
The Mets. Controversial finish on Thursday in their home opener. The ball hits the elbow of the batter, whose name I don't know. Michael Conforto, they're telling me. He leaned into the pitch. It resulted in the winning run scoring and totally bogus walk-off HBP to decide Mets Marlins. Not only did Conforto not try to get out of the way, but he very slightly moved his elbow to get hit by a strike, and the home plate umpire ignored it. That is some totally horse crap umping right there. Peter King tweeted that yesterday. So, all right.
I don't like injustice.
Not that one outcome means a damn thing in a 162-game baseball season, but it inspired today's draft. Teams that still should be salty about a loss all time, any time in the NFL, something they should still be pissed off, sorry, London, about, even today. Peter, go ahead. Take the first one.
Hello, London. Mike, I've got to take the Saints-Rams missed interference call in the NFC Championship game. How can you not call that? That's like the worst missed call. It may not in NFL history, but certainly in recent NFL history. Without any question, that's got to be number one. Every time I look at this play, I still think, how possibly is anybody looking at that and not calling it? I just can't believe it.
And the thing that still amazes me, and even though it's against the rules to do it, I'm amazed that Al Riveron didn't exercise his prerogative to yell at the referee, someone needs to drop a flag now, because if you don't, we're going to have a mess unlike any mess we've ever had. And they're still dealing with how to clean up that mess properly more than 2 years later. I'm going to go with the Tuck rule game. Raiders fans still salty. Raiders employees, coaches, players, anyone still there who has any tie back to that team. And obviously John Gruden back again as the head coach, still upset about it. I'm told that at one point, and this lasted for a while, back when they actually used fax machines, some of the employees of the Raiders organization had a still frame of Tom Brady getting hit by Charles Woodson at the top of the cover page of every fax that they sent out. That's how upset the organization still was about that call that robbed them of a berth in the AFC Championship in 2001.
Hey, look, you talk to Amy Trask now. Obviously, he was Al Davis's right-hand person with the Raiders. You talk to Amy Trask, and it takes her about 6 words to get her blood boiling and the veins sticking out of her neck. And you know, the thing about Raiders people, once you work for the Raiders, you learn one thing from Al Davis: vengeance is ours. And, you know, because that's, Al always operated that way. So if you work for the Raiders, you always felt like everybody's out to get us.
All right. And you know, one last thing about it, they ultimately changed that rule, but they waited like a decade to do it because they knew how obvious it would have been if they changed that rule in the aftermath. So I think it was like a 10 or 11 year statute of limitations that expired before they changed that rule. All right, Peter, round two, you're up.
You know, my favorite play, just when I start thinking about plays officials screwed up, is the Fail Mary game. And, you know, the Seattle Green Bay game, where in the end zone there is, you know, a mugging and a catch and all this. And, you know, basically you just can't believe that this is how this game really ended. You know, it's just hard to believe that they called a touchdown for it. It wasn't a touchdown, but they called it a touchdown.
And that moment ended the lockout of the regular officials back in 2012. That 3 weeks, it wasn't as big of a disaster as people in the league office feared it was going to be. But once that happened, by Thursday night, the regular officials were back on the job. And
yeah, because that was a Monday night game.
Yeah. And it also, you know, and it's impossible because you'd have to go back and play the rest of the season. But if you just go apples to apples and you take that loss and turn it into a win for the Packers, I think they would have had a bye, a home game in the playoffs. You know, things may have gone differently for them in the 2012 postseason if that loss had been a win. Next one for me, I'll go the Dez Cotted game from 2014, Cowboys and the Packers. I still think it was a catch. I think it was ruled, and I know it was ruled a catch on the field. I don't think there was enough, even under the prevailing definition of a catch at the time, to overturn the ruling on the field with clear and obvious evidence or indisputable visual evidence, the standard was at the time. He's got the ball. He's got multiple feet down. There's the ruling. The official comes over and says, that's a catch. I don't think there's nearly enough to say it wasn't, Peter. And if I'm a Cowboys fan, I'm still upset about it 7 years later.
Yeah, I don't blame you for being upset because look at every step of the way on this. And I totally understand, by virtue of the rule, when his hand hit the ground, the ball moved and all that. But man, he had the ball in his hand for a long time, Mike.
That lunging, that's the football move that they always talked about that wasn't codified. The football move, the lunging of the ball, multiple steps and the lunging of the ball, and the ruling on the field is it's a catch, and there's not indisputable visual evidence to overturn that ruling on the field. All right, round three, Peter, you're up.
Mike, my favorite bad call of all time, or miscall or no call of all time, has to be the snowplow game in New England in 1982. Obviously, you remember this. You know, it was a snowy day in Foxborough, Dolphins against the Patriots. And a guy on work release from a local prison was waved out on the field because he had the snowplow. Okay, and a guy was waved out on the field by Patriots coach Ron Meyer. And on the other sideline, Don Shula is screaming, you can't do that, you can't do that. But the snowplow comes on the field, clears a path, and John Smith, the kicker for the Patriots, kicks the field goal that wins the game, and the Dolphins lose. I remember Don Shula, even late in his career, I'm serious, this is the loss he was most bitter at, because he thought it was the loss that went against the spirit of every rule, that the home team cleared off a spot for its field goal kicker, which should not have happened. And so, I don't know. It's hilarious to watch, and it's hilarious also to watch and listen to Don Shula afterwards, just, you know, kind of go bat crap over it.
After all these years, it never really occurred to me, if you're going to do something shady and you need someone to actually do it, pick the guy who's already going back to prison anyway. Why does he care?
Right? Pick the guy on work release from prison.
Yeah. He's going back to jail anyway. Who cares if he does something he shouldn't have done? All right. Well, I think the control room knows what my final pick for this draft will be. Do I even need to say it? December 28, 1975. I was 10 years old. The Vikings had started that season 10-0. It was their best team of the 70s. The game is over. Roger Staubach pumps left, throws right. Nate Wright thrown to the ground by Drew Pearson. Paul Krause knows it. Paul Krause is pointing to him. He interfered. The officials were blind. Pearson threw the ball out of the stadium. One of the officials got hit in the head with a whiskey bottle. And there it is, slow motion. I really don't need to see it again. But Peter, look, I don't know anything about technique for defensive backs in 1975, but diving forward as the ball is coming in does not seem to be the acceptable way to defend. He was pushed. He was shoved. And yes, I am still salty about that 45 years later.
But Mike, you saw the flag come in, okay, right after that play. What did the official rule on that flag? Did he?
That wasn't a flag. That wasn't a flag. Somebody threw an orange. It wasn't a flag. I've seen that Zapruder film many times.
It looked like a flag.
I remember when I was a kid and I saw it flash across the bottom of the screen. I thought it was too. I was distraught. And as I've said many times before, that was the low point of my childhood. And if that's the low point of anyone's childhood, it's not a bad childhood. If that's the worst thing that happened to me from the age of 1 to 18, pretty good.
How did you become a Vikings fan?
Well, I grew up in Steelers territory, and everybody in the town that I lived in was a Steelers fan, and the Steelers were good then, and of course you had to be a Steelers fan, and Peter, you've known me long enough to know that the last thing I'm going to do is what I'm supposed to do, so I rebelled against being a Steelers fan. I would have had a much better childhood if I had been. 4 Super Bowl championships, that would have been nice, but you know, it's just there was just something about the purple, there was something about, you know, the Vikings were good at the time, so they were on TV. I liked the color. I liked the helmet. I liked Fran Tarkenton. I love Chuck Foreman. I love John Gilliam, if you remember him, number 42. And that was that. And, you know, I caught the virus. And there were many times I wish I hadn't, but it was too late to change it by the time I was 10 years old. All right, let's take a break. There it is. Thanks. We're going to break with it. Well, good. There's the evidence. Pass interference, Drew Pearson. We'll be right back. There's the orange.
That looks like a flag. That's a flag.
Patrick Mahomes made a stir on Easter Sunday when he had a walking boot on in a family photo. There he is at Augusta. No walking boot on the left foot. Good news for Chiefs fans. Now, he posted some pictures that were clearly part of an Adidas partnership. And I don't know that Adidas makes a walking boot, so he had to put the yellow shoe on, Peter. But look, he said he's going to be fine. Had that turf toe, had that surgery. He looks fine to me, and Chiefs fans can exhale. The walking boot was off yesterday.
Look, the one thing you knew about Mahomes is that time was on his side. If you do surgery on such a serious injury that you know that he had to live with during the season, if you do it in February and know that really in 4 months you're supposed to be absolutely perfect, back to normal, what are you going to miss, particularly in an off season that is likely to be disrupted?
3 days after the Super Bowl, he had that surgery, which tells you how bad it was. That's it for today's program. Have a great weekend. See you next week.
There are two things that are absolutely true. Grandma loves you, and she would never say no to McDonald's. So treat yourself to a Grandma McFlurry with your order today. It's what Grandma would want. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.